Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Scott Frankel, and I represent the defendant appellant, Wasvaldo Villegas. The brief that we filed raised four issues, and I'm, with the permission of the Court today, I would like to address just one issue, and that would be whether the trial court erred in refusing to give the missing requested missing witness instruction.
But the witness was available to the defense, just
correct.
Like it was to the government.
The
so
witness
why,
was,
you, why were you entitled to missing witness instruction?
The witness was physically available to both sides, but under the law of the Seventh Circuit, as it's been developed, the witness missing instruction is appropriate not only in circumstances where the witness is physically available to both sides, but where it appears that the witness is only peculiarly available to one side.
How is he peculiarly available to just the government?
When the witness obviously has a bias or a predisposition to one of the sides of the case, the witness is peculiarly available to that side. In this case, the witness was the paid confidential informant of the government. He had been receiving payments, so he was essentially in the employ of the government. In addition, he had been receiving benefits, immigration benefits, which were substantial in the form of deferred deportation. So, and I believe that his expectation was that he would continue to receive those deferred deportation benefits, if possible.
Even though you didn't get a missing witness instruction, I assume there was an argument made. Why didn't the government call the missing witness to testify?
That's correct, Judge. In this case, I believe that there was at least a reference made in the closing argument that the government could have called this witness. However, I think that requiring the defense to make that argument in their closing argument it should be a fallback position because it forces the defense to take on the burden of the case and essentially shifts the burden from the government to the defense, because what will happen then is the government will get up and say that the witness is, that the defense has subpoena power just like the government. And normally, if possible, the defense wants to avoid bringing out that argument because it's a burden-shifting argument and the defense has the benefit of not having to present any evidence if the government hasn't proved its case beyond reasonable doubt.
Mr. Frankel, Mr. Villegas received a substantially below-guideline sentence. But does he really don't want to open that up by contesting the gun enhancement?
No, he doesn't want to put in jeopardy his below-guideline sentence. However, he does believe that if the trial court were advised that the gun enhancement were improperly imposed, that she would impose an even lower sentence than the one that he got. Because
how can we seriously say that he didn't anticipate the gun? They were robbing armed guards. He first suggested the use of a taser or a gun. He may not have brought the gun to the scene, but he suggested it, he knew about it, he acquiesced.
Judge, there were recorded conversations that captured Mr. Villegas telling the confidential informant that a weapon would not be necessary. They discussed the issue of the taser,
but if we listen to the audio tapes of that first meeting, with Mr. Villegas, the informant, and the FBI agent, who's going to be the first person to mention tasers and guns?
I believe that Mr. Villegas, he talked about a taser, but he, I think, was pretty clear throughout the conversations that were recorded that a gun would not be necessary. And what we had here was the confidential informant who was given the gun by the government agents. The confidential informant suggested the gun. The confidential informant showed the gun to Mr. Villegas. The confidential informant brought the gun to the rendezvous that occurred right before the planned armed robbery. If the government and had not injected the gun into the case, there would have been no gun at all as part of the incident. So the idea...
When you're robbing armed guards, you just go in like they... Like the police in England with no gun. Maybe they... Even they maybe have guns today. I don't know.
Mr. Villegas and the confidential informant discussed how Mr. Villegas believed that the guards would just turn the money over, that force would not be necessary, that a weapon would not be necessary, that there was an inside operator who knew Mr. Villegas and he would turn the money over. I think Mr. Villegas testified to all of this and testified to all of it that he did not believe that a weapon would be required to complete this armed robbery that was being planned by them.
Oh, I just want to go back to the missing witness situation because I know you cite this Johnson case and some other cases. Are any of these situations where you have confidential informants?
No.
Witnesses who were confidential informants?
No, Your Honor. And
for the government?
The Seventh Circuit cases, in addition, do not involve the issue of the confidential informant.
And there's no other circuit that's
not that I was
said that it's in the peculiar purview of the government to produce a CI. I mean, that they're peculiarly available to the government. There's no other circuit.
No, but I would say that the situation of the confidential informant raises an even stronger argument for the missing witness instruction because the confidential informant is groomed and cultivated by the government. In this case, the confidential informant, as I've already stated, was...
Oh, I know he's available. I just wondered if you had any authority to support that position, specifically in terms of a confidential informant who's actually been produced, because there are many situations where the government may choose not to bring this confidential informant forward and may accede to a missing witness instruction, but this is different. I didn't see any authority.
I did not cite a specific case involving a confidential informant. Judge Williams, I'd also like to point out that in this particular case, the confidential informant had raised an allegation, a false allegation against the trial attorney, making it even clearer that he was inside the orbit of the government's control and was not available to the defense
right.
trial
yeah,
attorney.
Yeah, I'm aware of that argument. I just wondered if you had any other authority. Thank you.
So, in our view, the confidential informant was peculiarly within the ambit of the government. He was peculiarly available to the government. And there's a second component to the issue of the missing witness instruction, and that is whether his testimony would have been cumulative or redundant. The courts have held that if the witness's testimony would have been redundant to other witnesses, obviously, you would not get a missing witness instruction under those circumstances. Here, it's clear that the testimony of the confidential informant would have elucidated aspects of the case that were not otherwise made clear through the testimony of the witnesses who did testify. For example,
you know, Mr. Frankel, you're really doing a wonderful job for your client, but look, you know, we've got this audio and video taped evidence. We have the stolen license plate. The extensive planning and the surveillance leading up to the day. If the planning wasn't enough, stealing the plates for the getaway car, helping put them on, hurrying the informant along because he'd already seen the armored car, you know, arrive, you know. I mean, there's an awful lot of evidence here.
Judge, the issue that we're addressing today, the missing witness instruction, goes to whether or not he received a fair trial. And I believe that that's a separate issue from
the
sufficiency
of
the evidence argument.
So are you conceding on the sufficiency?
No, we raised that as a separate issue.
I know you did, but I mean your response to the question sounded like you might have been wavering a little.
Yeah, Jay, I understand the reality of the case, mm-hmm. and I read the record just like you did, and I understand the position of the mm-hmm. court on the issue of the sufficiency of the evidence. It's a very steep hill for
hard
us to climb.
To hoe. Oh.
Mm-hmm. But I'm not waiving that issue. We raised it in our brief. We're just focusing on the missing witness instruction here today. And if there are no other questions, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Judge.
Okay. Mr. Diamantatos?
Your Honors, good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Tinos Diamantatos, and I'm appearing on behalf of the appellee of the United States. The District Court...
What about the fact that, you know, what do we do about this bizarre claim that the informant made, the defense counsel tried to bribe him? Wouldn't that really make an informant effectively unavailable to be called by the defense? I mean, who would call the defense?
It would not, Judge. What the defense could have done, if they truly wanted to call the CI in this case, is ask Judge Kendall, outside the presence of the jury, instruct the CI to not go anywhere near the allegations, false or otherwise, that he made to the government in the days before this issue came to light, when the government went and interviewed him. It could have asked Judge Kendall to instruct the witness, as judges do in many situations, and tell witnesses to stay away from a particular subject matter, instruct the government on cross, if it was going to be the defense witness.
Judge Kendall had said, no, everything's fair game here.
Well, that's a risk.
And what?
That's a risk, Your Honor, that the defense would take by calling the witness. I could say that the government had no intention of going into that subject matter, especially in light of the fact that, on the record, the government did state that there was no criminal investigation into the conduct of the attorneys in this case. Judge, I think a little bit of background here would help shed light on why a missing witness instruction absolutely should not have been given in this case, and Judge Kendall committed no error whatsoever in not giving it. And
this was a jury. This was a bench trial, wasn't it?
It wasn't, Judge. This was a jury trial.
But was a jury trial?
Jury trial, Your Honor. There was a type
you
of
error.
There was
error.
Yeah.
I have an error in my
brief.
In my jurisdictional statement,
right,
where I said it was a bench trial. That was a mistake. It was a jury trial. The government had no intention of calling the CI. His testimony would have been cumulative. As Your Honor's already mentioned, there was voluminous audio and videotape evidence. The CI in this case was a living, breathing, walking microphone. He was there to record what was coming out of Villegas's mouth. He was there to record what exactly Villegas was doing. And he was there to record what Villegas was doing in response to the CI's comments, in response to the CI showing him a firearm and ammunition and a bulletproof vest sitting in the CI's trunk of his car. The government had no intention of calling him. His testimony would have been cumulative. In an abundance of caution, the government went and interviewed the CI, who, of course, the government had learned was being deported. We didn't hide the CI.
By the way, the government had... what did you say about deported?
As the case proceeded to trial, Judge, we learned, I received a phone call, that the CI was no longer signed up with either DEA or FBI, that he was now here illegally and was in immigration custody to be deported. At the very next status in the case, we brought the issue up to the court. We certainly didn't want there to be a situation where the CI would have been deported and then we would have come to the November trial in 08 and there would have been an issue with a missing witness instruction. We raised the issue for the court. We told the court that we had no objection to a defense request for a material witness warrant. We didn't want to ask for the material witness warrant because we couldn't affirm, as the statute requires, that this witness is material for us because, in our view, his testimony would have been cumulative. We had the agent testimony. We had the audio and videotape evidence in the case. Judge Kendall, of course, by agreement of the parties, issued a material witness warrant for the CI, and he sat in custody waiting for the trial to finish. We presented our case in chief. We put on agent testimony. We put on other testimony to prove up our case. We played the video and audio tape evidence for the jury. During that process, we went out and interviewed the CI. We hadn't spoken to him in months, Judge. And I think what's important here is Judge Kendall noted this on the record, that the CI was equally hostile to the government. We went out to talk to him, and he was unhappy with the fact that we no longer considered him a source. He was unhappy with the fact he was being deported, and he didn't want to see us, equally as much as he didn't want to see defense counsel. He went on to dictate certain things that allegedly happened, according to him, with regard to the defense attorneys and their investigator. We memorialized that in the 302 FBI report without specifically making any reference to whether we believed them.
Was that the only thing he discussed with you, because you said he didn't want to see you? Was that the only topic when he saw you?
Here's what happened, Judge. We sat down with him, and he said, I don't want to see you guys. Mm-hmm. We told him that he may very well be called as a witness, and we were there to talk to him about his recollection of the events in the case. Before we got into his recollection of the facts in the case, he started saying, the defendants have already been here to talk to me. Before I was taken into immigration custody, the defendant himself kept coming to my house every day. He looked at me and said, Mr. Diamantados, you told me not to call you directly in this case, so I couldn't tell you all of these things, which is actually true. When I prepared him for grand jury testimony, and this is in the record as far as our colloquy with Judge Kendall on the issue, I told him to not have contact with me directly, to call an agent if he had any issue. The agent was on a leave. He was in Afghanistan for several months, so the CI did not call the agent to tell him about this conduct. Regardless, we put it in a 302. We talked to him about what his direct or cross-examination would be. We tendered the 302 to defense counsel, to Judge Kendall. The chief of the criminal division of the U.S. Attorney's Office appeared in open court, told Judge Kendall, on the record, we are not investigating this conduct. There's no way to substantially corroborate it, period. Judge Kendall, in an abundance of caution, called the Federal Defender's Office, and Mr. Murphy appeared as independent counsel for Mr. Villegas on this particular issue to explain to him that there may be a conflict in light of the allegations made by the CI. Mr. Villegas was given a reasonable opportunity to talk to Mr. Murphy, and then on the record, under oath, waived that conflict. We went forward with our case. We rested. The defense said they wanted to call the CI. We called the marshals each and every day, and the CI was physically brought present to the 24th floor upstairs, or actually downstairs from here. The government went up each and every morning to make sure that the CI was physically present, and we advised Judge Kendall each and every trial day that should the defense want to call the CI, all they had to do was make a phone call upstairs. And Judge Kendall noted that on the record. So to say that the witness was peculiarly with the government's control is inaccurate. Number one, he was physically present. Number two, he was equally hostile to both sides. Number three, should the defense have really wanted...
Just tell me this. Did trial counsel know how angry he was with you?
Yes. Judge Kendall, Your Honor, and I could point to the section in the brief. It is actually on page 43 to 44 of the government's brief. And as far as the trial record, it's cited as trial 1,145 through 46, 1,148. And this is Judge Kendall saying, see, I disagree with this as being worse. I think it is not worse. I think what we have here is we have a whole mess of information on both sides, some of which says that not only is he not missing, but your client has had contact with him as well as you. And I mean, you have admitted that you went to attempt to interview him. Whether or not he actually agreed to help you by not responding to you does not make him missing to you. Judge Kendall went on to say, he's here. You could call 5294 right now and bring him down. I think it's a strategy call. He's available. And then this is the point to your question, Judge Rovner, where Judge Kendall says, in fact, right now, this guy's ticked off at the government. He doesn't feel like he's being paid. You just made a statement to me that you think he's trying to mess up the case. So I'm not sure that the statement doesn't make it more likely that, you know, you both can call him. Whether one of you can call him, it's at your own risk. And, of course, the judge goes on. And that's what's key, Your Honor. It was a strategy call on behalf of the defense to not call the CI. And the first point I made was if the defense really wanted to call the CI, they could have asked Judge Kendall to instruct the witness to limit his testimony and go nowhere near that subject matter. I'll be brief with my response to the gun enhancement. Judge, as you pointed out, the first meeting that was recorded between the undercover agent, the CI, and Mr. Villegas, it's Mr. Villegas who says, I'm going to use a taser. Mr. Villegas alleged that this person that they would be robbing was in on it, but didn't know all of the details of the robbery, so that person could pass a polygraph exam that the armored car company would undoubtedly give him. Villegas talked about the taser. Villegas talked about using a .22 caliber firearm, and the undercover in response said, let's use a bigger gun. Let's use a .45 caliber weapon. And, of course, without belaboring this, the meetings went on, the robbery was discussed, the ATM location was cased. What's huge is the day before the robbery, Mr. Villegas was there in black and white, actually in color, for the jury to see, looking into the trunk of the CI's car, who brought a .45 caliber firearm, a bulletproof vest, and ammunition. If Mr. Villegas had issue with the gun being used, he could have said so. Rather, he showed up the next day doing his part by bringing the stolen license plates, by bringing a garage door opener for the getaway location. He had no issue with the gun being used. And the crime itself dictates that a gun would have to be used. This was a crime that was violent in nature, where two individuals, Villegas and the CI, were supposedly going to overtake a guard who was going to be armed carrying large sums of money. Mr. Villegas received a fair trial. The jury's verdict should not be disturbed, Your Honors, and we respectfully request that you affirm his conviction and that you affirm his below-guideline sentence.
Okay, can you resolve something for me?
Yes, Judge.
You say the Walgreens was 4 blocks from the bank, and they say a mile. So what is it?
It was 0.4 miles, Judge, according to MapQuest, and that was in the record.
Okay.
0.4 miles. When you put in the Walgreens location and the LaSalle Bank ATM hut, MapQuest said it was 0.4 miles. The two, meaning the CI and Mr. Villegas, had discussed meeting at the Walgreens the night before so they could swap out the plates, make sure the disguise was fine. So that was their meet location. That was the final place that they were going to go to.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Frankel.
I don't see how it could have been a strategy decision not to call the confidential informant after the trial, or after the trial lawyer had already been accused of serious wrongdoing, that Mr. Glockner from the U.S. Attorney's Office had come down to court to answer questions from the judge about whether a criminal investigation would be opened, and the trial attorney knew at that point that the confidential informant was obviously seriously hostile to him and the defendant. Whether or not the witness expressed hostility toward the government, I don't think is even the point. The point is whether under the circumstances it's clear that there's bias from the confidential informant. At that point, the confidential informant was resentful because he was in custody, he had been brought to court, he was obviously a volatile kind of guy because he was able to put together this entire plan for the bank robbery and bring Mr. Villegas into it. And so when the government talks about the confidential informant not being happy with them, I don't think that changes the situation that he was within their ambit and control. And for those reasons, Your Honor, we would argue that the missing witness instruction should have been given. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to all parties. Mr. Frankel, were you appointed by the... You weren't. Okay. Well, so nice to see you appointed or not. And nice to see you, Mr. Diamante. All right. Thank you.